those who entertain such thoughts as, he abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me, will not still their hatred. For in this world, hatreds are never pacified by hatred. They are pacified by love. This is an eternal law. So those of you familiar with the Dhammapada, that famous collection of the Buddha's sayings, will recognise these as verses 3 and 5 of the very first chapter of the Dhammapada. But they also occur in another place in the ancient Pali Buddhist scriptures, which gives us the most vivid record of the life of the Buddha. They're part of a response of the Buddha to a particular situation, had arisen within the Buddhist community. In fact, among a large section of the disciples of the Buddha. And it seems that in a place called Kasumbi, the monks, the bhikkhus, the full-time disciples of the Buddha, had got into a very, very serious dispute. Two large factions had seriously fallen out ostensibly over someone leaving a pot of water in the communal latrine. It always seems to be about pots of water in the communal latrine, or who has or hasn't done the washing up. Actually, the problem really is the tip of an iceberg. You feel that there are deep interpersonal issues going on between these factions of monks. And it's very, very serious, because the texts tell us that these monks were wounding each other with verbal arrows. They were quarrelling, they were deep in disputes, and they were even brawling. It seems that there was physical conflict. Might seem a bit of a surprise that Buddhist monks in their yellow robes might be trying to take each other out. And the Buddha was told about this, and he realised he had to go to those Kasumbi monks to do something about it, to try and affect the situation positively. And he told them, just stop. Monks, just stop the quarrelling. Just put it down. Let it go. Put it aside. But the monks didn't want to do that. And one of them said to the Buddha, Bhagwan, Lord, Blessed One, Bhante, be comfortable. Just go away, be comfortable, meditate, we'll be responsible for this, we'll sort it all out. But the Buddha could tell he was being sort of fobbed off, patronised even. So he just kept saying, monks, stop, put it down, put it aside. Stop. Develop metta for one another, loving kindness for one another. But he continued to get this brush off from one of the monks who seemed to be the spokesman for the situation. Be comfortable, Lord. Be comfortable, Bhante. Be at ease. We'll sort it out. Well, can you imagine? The Buddha is there, your teacher. You have to imagine the Buddha as your teacher, your spiritual friend, the very embodiment of wisdom and compassion. He's taken the trouble to come and help you. He's there face to face with you to help you in your disputes. He's asking you to put this all down, put down the conflict, the hatred, the anger. And you patronize him. You treat him as a sort of simpleton. And the next day it's said that after begging his food on his own and rising from meditation afterwards, the Buddha just stood, looked around at the situation, and he just said those words, those who entertain such thoughts as, he abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me, will not still their hatred, for in this world Hatreds are never pacified by hatred. They are pacified by love. This is an eternal law. These and other verses. And you can imagine the deep feeling with which the Buddha was saying this. And then he wandered off alone into the forest, along the forest paths. It's a very, very interesting episode, this. Tells us many things. One thing it tells us is that you might come physically face to face with the Buddha, but that does not mean that you are able to receive, to take in what he really is and what he wants to communicate, even if you are, even if you say that you're a disciple of the Buddha. The Buddha, we must remember, is not a god or a saviour who, through his mere presence, can change you, save you. The Buddha, yes, is an enlightened man, which is a completely different category of being. We can't fit Buddha, enlightened man, into any categories that we have available to us. He's not a god or anything like a god, but neither is he an ordinary man. The Buddha began life, as you all know, as an ordinary man. He's Gotama of the Sakya clan, but through his efforts, through his own unaided efforts, he transformed himself, he developed himself into enlightened man through seeing things as they really are, through seeing with wisdom. And what he does for others is to show them a path to such seeing, so that they may see that truth for themselves. Through such seeing, real satisfaction, indwelling happiness, bliss, fulfillment can come. This is the Buddha's experience, as well as liberation from all restriction and all limitation. The Buddha can show us the way to that. He can point the way to that for us, but he can't transport us there. We have to want to go there ourselves. We need to want what he is offering, and we need to make the effort to follow what he is teaching. As the Buddha again says in the Dhammapada, by you must the keen effort be made. The Buddhas only point the way. So these disputing disciples didn't want to hear, didn't want to make the effort. They rejected on that occasion their teacher, their spiritual friend, the Buddha. There's something else about this incident that it's worth reflecting on. Some of you might be wondering, how is it that the Buddha has all these disciples? How is it that he has a community of disciples? Isn't Buddhism a religion for solitaries? Aren't Buddhists people who spend a lot of time alone, meditating, shunning other people? This can be the way people think about the Buddha and Buddhism. The Buddha, of course, was a deep meditator, a profound meditator. He spent a lot of time in the jungle as a solitary wanderer, searching for the truth. And in that deep meditation, far away in the depths of silence, the Buddha realized the truth of things. The deep wisdom emerged out of the silence that he experienced in meditation, in the depths of the forest alone. Out in that deep wisdom saw the impermanence, the changing nature of all things. That wisdom revealed that there is in fact no fixed and separate self anywhere in existence. And in seeing this, all of the Buddha's bonds and limitations just dropped away, and he entered that liberation that we call nirvana, that bliss of liberation. But along with this wisdom and this liberation, there came the experience of love, of compassion, and the experience of communication. The necessity of communicating that experience to others. Communication is the overflow of the Buddha's wisdom and compassion. He wants to make known what he knows so that others can taste the bliss of liberation. So one of the things you find with the Buddha's enlightenment is the tremendous release of tremendous energy. The Buddha is a being of unlimited, unfettered energy. So after the enlightenment, the Buddha doesn't remain seated under the Bodhi tree. He walks. He walks in those brown, discoloured, rag-patched robes. He goes right out to communicate what he knows, what he tastes. He wants to share what he knows. And what, of course, he was sharing was not information, not facts. It was much more a matter of communicating his being, communicating his experience. And in doing that, in communicating his experience directly, he begins to formulate the vision, what he's seeing. He begins to articulate what he's seeing in clear principles and concepts, as well as articulating a path of practices which will lead people to that vision. And there's tremendous energy in the Buddha's communication. Sometimes in the old Pali text, you have to really imagine this, really feel this. The old Pali text can be a bit sort of stereotypical and a little bit clunky sometimes. But you get these moments where the energy of his communication really comes through, as well as the joy, there's no other word for it, the inspiration he feels when another man has seen what he sees, has received what he is showing, who not only understands it, but tastes what he tastes. So the very first person who saw what the Buddha was seeing, who saw the very simple truth, whatever arises, passes. If it begins, it ends. A very, very simple truth. In conceptual terms, a profound truth when you really see it and know it. When Kundanya, as his name was, saw this, and the Buddha knew that he was seeing it, witnessed that he saw it, he bursts forth. The form they call it is anudana, a breathing forth. It's the upward moving breath, not the out breath, but the breath of inspiration, the air of inspiration. And he just said, "Kundanya knows. Kundanya knows." He says it ecstatically, exultantly. There is another enlightened man in this world. So the Buddha's communication wasn't about giving sermons, although of course he would give on occasion formal discourses to assemblies of people, but it was also a matter of communicating with people, meeting people, befriending people, empathizing with people, meeting people where they actually are, connecting with their particular issues, problems, inspirations, aspirations, and connecting that to the path of spiritual growth and development. And it's out of that communication that the community of disciples of the Buddha forms. The Sangha, as we call it, forms, comes together. And it seems to have formed pretty quickly. The Buddha's communication after his enlightenment, it really is electric. There's tremendous energy, tremendous creativity bursting forth in northern India at that time. People, of course, were not only getting what the Buddha was saying, not only realizing what the Buddha was saying, they were becoming enlightened themselves. And that opening up of wisdom in them resulted in love and compassion in them. So they began, like the Buddha, to see the potential for enlightenment all around them as well. So you find the Buddha's disciples just going out to communicate what they were seeing. So quite quickly, communities of the Buddha's disciples developed, not just in northern India, but in other parts of India as well. So you had disciples of disciples of disciples of the Buddha, all these people on the path, all these people wanting to come together to practice the Dharma. But you know how it is. Not everybody who became a disciple of the Buddha, or a disciple of a disciple of the Buddha, not all of them were enlightened or irreversible on the path to enlightenment. They would have been inspired at first and committed to the path, making effort, but then, you know, the old habits come up. You know how it is. You know, you get very excited perhaps when you first come along to the Buddhist center and you meditate, and you may even start to feel, wow, you know, this is it. I'm on the way. But then, you know, the old habits start to reassert themselves. We're still with ourselves. We're still with our problems, our difficulties, and other people are with their problems and their difficulties. And so when this happens, conflicts can begin to happen, did happen among the Buddha's disciples over water pots or something else. We've all got our versions of water pots. Those disciples who were in conflict that I talked about at the beginning of the talk, they could just as well have been saying to each other, I don't like your face, as you left the water pot there. Or, I don't like the way your robe is worn. You know, I don't like the way you speak. I don't like the way you walk. It really is on that level. This is what happens when people, when we come together, but then lose our connection with the spiritual, the transcendental ideal. When we lose our connection with that, our limited, bounded and restricted selves reassert themselves. And then when that happens, you get conflict, disharmony, disputes in the spiritual community. So much so, it might even cease to become a spiritual community. It's only when you put them down and look up, look out at what really unites you, the real meaning of life, the higher transcendental ideal of wisdom and compassion, which is actually our deepest humanity, only then can you begin to start coming together. So the Buddha leaves those disputing monks, not in a huff. Buddhas don't do huffs. He goes in equanimity into the forest, enjoying the forest. The Buddha, we know, loved nature, lived in nature, and loving the natural unfolding of the Dharma. Loving, you know, the natural unfolding of his enlightenment, if you like. And one story tells us that while he's in the forest, in solitude, he's served by a great bull elephant. This is a really charming story, who brings him water. And this bull elephant had had a parallel experience to the Buddha. He'd suddenly found himself, this bull elephant, being really bothered by the competitive young bulls, you know, always going up and butting him in the side, and the nagging she-elephants. And he just got fed up and just wandered off to enjoy the peace of the jungle. And at some point, the two of them met, the great bull elephant of the Dharma, the Buddha. The Buddha is sometimes called the bull elephant. And the real bull elephant, they look at each other. There's a great meeting of minds. Very charming story. But then later, one evening, the Buddha made his way to a grove, a sort of park of beautiful, slender sal trees, which are rather like silver birches, to a retreat place at a place called Gasinga, where he knew that three of his disciples were staying, practicing the Dharma, practicing the teaching. And he went there to see how they were getting on. It was something that the Buddha used to do. He, you know, would often go and see his disciples in retreat, just to see if they need any help, if they need any further instruction, if they needed any encouragement. He was a very responsible teacher and spiritual friend in that way. He went out of his way to make sure that his disciples were okay. And the park was protected by a park keeper, a sort of watchman. And when he saw the Buddha coming, he said, you can't go in there, wanderer. You can't go in. There are three spiritual brothers there who are intent on reaching the highest good, so I can't let you in. A very interesting detail, this, because the watchman is probably a Buddhist layman who's devoted to the three monks in the grove, but he doesn't know who the Buddha is. He's never seen the Buddha before. And of course, there's no, you know, as far as we know, nobody did any drawings of the Buddha that were distributed and all the rest of it. He just sees a wanderer coming out of the jungle, coming into the park, and he doesn't want these monks who he's supporting to be disturbed. And this is interesting because we mustn't think that the Buddha looked as he does in traditional Buddhist art, you know, with a bump on his head and bright, well-laundered ceremonial robes and golden skin. You know, we mustn't think that, you know, we'd all know who the Buddha was. It wasn't like that. He was just another wanderer in his rag robes. In other places, he's not recognized by disciples of his disciples. And the Buddha doesn't draw attention to himself. He doesn't say to the park keeper, look, I'm the Buddha. I'm the daddy. You know, out the way. Let me in. He doesn't do anything like that. This is not the Buddha's way. The Buddha is sometimes sort of anonymous. He even said of himself towards the end of his life that he would move into different groups of people, different gatherings of people, different communities of people, and he would wear their clothes and speak their language to show them the Dharma, to show them the truth attuned to their particular circumstances. But they wouldn't even know who or what he was. And then he would just leave them uplifted. There's this wonderful sense of empathy that the Buddha has, and not drawing attention to himself. But anyway, one of the monks in the park saw that it was the Buddha, his teacher, coming, and the name of this monk was Anuruddha, a very close disciple of the Buddha, who had a great love for the Buddha, and he called to the watchman, "It's all right, good park keeper, it's all right, this is our teacher, this is the Blessed One, this is the Buddha who has come." And then he called to his two friends, his two spiritual brothers, Nandiya and Kimbila. He called to them. They, it seems, were among the trees, perhaps meditating, we don't know, but he says, "Come out, friends, come out. It's our teacher, it's the Blessed One who has come." And you can hear, ringing through the text, the joy that Anuruddha is feeling, the simple, straightforward joy that the Buddha, his teacher, his spiritual friend, has come. And all three of them make the Buddha welcome. Kimbila and Nandiya and Anuruddha, they make the Buddha welcome. They take his bowl, they bring water for him to wash his bare feet, water for him to drink, they make him a seat, they make him comfortable, and they bow down to him. This is a very traditional Indian way of showing love and respect to a teacher. They fully welcome him and receive him into the grove. And remember, it's the cool of the evening among the sweet-scented sal trees. And we can learn something even from this little detail. If we want to come face to face with the Buddha, if we want to see him, if we want to open to the qualities of enlightenment, we need to make him welcome. We need to treat him as an honoured guest in the house of ourself. This is, of course, what we're doing in the puja. When we practice puja, what we're doing is evoking moods, different emotional, devotional moods and attitudes in order to make the qualities of enlightenment welcome. Puja are really rituals of courtesy in which we're being the perfect hosts, the perfect hosts, so that the qualities of enlightenment can be taken in, can be received. This might seem strange talking like this, but if you're serious about gaining enlightenment, you have to feel that you're opening and receiving and expanding, becoming more alert to, alive to the truth that is there. So back to our story. Having done that, the 3 monks sit with the Buddha. They look at him, and he looks at them. They practice what in India is called taking darshan, taking the sight, taking the vision of your teacher. They see him, they are seen by him. And they're happy to do just that. But the Buddha is deeply interested in these 3 monks. He wants to know how they are, how they're getting on. So he doesn't start giving them a lecture. He asks them, "I hope you're all keeping well. I hope you're all comfortable. I hope you're having no trouble getting your alms food." So the Buddha asks these questions first. Are you well? Are you comfortable? Are you dwelling at ease? And very important, are you getting your food, your daily food? And of course, these monks have to beg for their food each day. And sometimes the Buddha and his monks didn't get their food. People would refuse them. So he wants to know that they're okay, that they are fed, that they're comfortable, that they're well. And of course, this is what we do when we communicate, when we meet. When we meet, we put each other at ease by asking how we are on a basic human level. And it's the same with the Buddha. That's what he does. Sometimes we think that if we're with a spiritual teacher, we ought immediately and all the time be asking spiritual questions. You know, I remember when I first met Sangharakshita, I was always asking him questions about shunyata and tantra and things like that at any sort of opportunity. And used to be quite weird for him. But there is a time and a place to ask questions. I remember Sangharakshita once saying, this wasn't to me, I don't think it was directed to me, but I remember him saying that it was a bit difficult to answer questions about shunyata, about emptiness, while everybody was tucking into their potatoes. So first, the Buddha wants to know about their basic human needs and condition. And they say that, yes, everything is fine. They're comfortable, they're getting enough food. So he goes a bit deeper and he asks, I hope that you're all living in concord, living in harmony, with mutual appreciation, without disputing, like milk and water blended, viewing each other with loving eyes. And in these words you have the Buddha's vision of what an ideal sangha, an ideal spiritual community is, an ideal human community for that matter. They dwell in harmony, with mutual appreciation, viewing each other with loving eyes, like milk and water blended. The Buddha knows how valuable, how essential harmony is to human life and to spiritual life. He knows how damaging disharmony is, how painful it is, and how it blights human relations and therefore human development. So he wants to know if they're in harmony. This isn't incidental to their spiritual life. It's a firm foundation of spiritual life. He wants to know if they are friends, in other words. He wants to know if they love each other. He knows how important friendship is to human life. And they reply, yes, we do live like this. Sometimes people think that the spiritual life is about driving forward alone and friendship is for the weak or whatever. But real, genuine, non-clinging, non-exclusive friendship is so important for spiritual development. We need to be able to do that. We maybe need to be able to do that kind of friendship, to be open to that kind of friendship. If we are, it's a sign of real spiritual development and growth. Why it is a sign of growth, we'll see in a moment, because the Buddha then asks, Well, how do you live like this? How have you achieved this state of affairs, of dwelling in such love and harmony? And Anuruddha replies that, first of all, he's reflected that it's a great gain for me that I am living with such companions in the spiritual life. So in other words, Anuruddha feels gratitude to his two friends for their companionship. He's pleased that they follow the path that he is following. He's pleased, he's grateful, he's enriched that they are with him, practicing alongside him. Gratitude is such an important human quality, spiritual quality. You could give a whole talk, a whole series of talks on gratitude. And one wonders if gratitude is becoming increasingly difficult to feel, to experience in our high-tech consumer world. And if it is becoming more difficult to feel and experience, then spiritual life is going to be more difficult to practice. We're in a world where we're encouraged and we get obsessed by always looking for the new thing, the latest thing that we must have, that will enrich our world, overlooking what we have, what is really enriching our lives, what is really important to our lives, including, of course, our Buddhist friends and companions. So often, you know, they are not good enough. We find fault with them and we start looking around, you know, for other spiritual friends or teachers, when in fact, when we look around, if we look around, we'd realise how rare it is and how wonderful it is that we have a path, that we have a practice and people who are practicing with us. If we dwelt more on what we already have, we would make more of ourselves and then we would learn to love. Anuruddha feels enriched by his friends. They are a gain for him, and out of that gratitude arises selfless love, metta, loving kindness. For Anuruddha then says that he maintains, cultivates, develops bodily, verbal and mental acts of loving kindness, of metta to his two friends, which they also practice in relation to him. He maintains that love when he's with them and when he is away from them, outwardly, directly, as well as within the privacy of his own mind. Anuruddha's spiritual practice, Nandiya's spiritual practice, Kimbala's spiritual practice, in other words, their spiritual practice is nothing other than a continuous metta-bhavana, development of loving kindness for one another, outside of meditation as well as in sitting meditation, a continuous flow of loving acts. Their lives are a continual act of loving kindness. This is really extraordinary and something to really reflect on. Sometimes people say and think metta bhavana is an elementary practice, a beginner's practice that you need to kind of get beyond and, you know, take up the mysteries of so-called higher practices. But the Buddha himself is very, very clear. Continuous metta, loving kindness in all areas of life, makes you irreversible on the path to enlightenment. And personally, I believe metta, the metta bhavana, and practicing metta in daily life is the most important spiritual practice that we could undertake. It's more important than any other practice, especially in the modern West, in the modern world. And because, and this is a generalization, I'm very well aware of that, people seem so emotionally frozen, so cut off, so alienated from themselves and other people, so frightened even of really experiencing themselves and what's around them. Metta is the key to this. Metta is the key to genuine connection with real emotion, positive emotion, creative emotion, and to genuine connection with others. Metta is the key to genuine selflessness. In metta, we dissolve the hard distinction between self and other, and that is the key to wisdom, the key to liberation. There's more to it than that. People in this world need to be loved straightforwardly, without strings, without expectation, in full awareness of their spiritual potential. People need this quality of love. And if Buddhists won't love like that, then who will love like that? But Anuruddha goes even further than that. He tells the Buddha that he practices selflessness in relation to his two friends. He tells the Buddha that he sets aside what he wishes to do and does what his friends wish to do. In all the affairs of daily life, he just practices putting aside his own ideas of what to do, how things ought to be done. He just lets go of all that and just surrenders happily to his two friends, and then makes the astonishing statement, "We have three bodies, but assuredly we have only one mind." And his two friends, Nandiya and Kimbila, speak at this point, and they all say, "This is how we live, in harmony, in concord, in mutual appreciation, with no dispute, like milk and water blended, viewing each other with loving eyes. We have three bodies, but only one mind." The Pali here is ekacitta. Eka meaning one, citta meaning heart, mind, heart, consciousness. Anuruddha and his friends are not scared to say that he and his friends are one. He doesn't quickly add, "But we're all unique, particular individuals." There's no need to say it. This is not the oneness of group consciousness in which people are driven by their lowest common denominator, their common hatred or their common greed. This is the oneness that comes when you transcend your limited and separate self-centeredness. When a number of people are doing that, you expand up and out of all limitation. This is what ekacitta means. It's the oneness that arises when individuals have genuine metta and love for one another, and that's fully expressed without any holding back. Now, you'd think that the Buddha would stop his questioning of the three monks here. He, no doubt, delighted by what he's hearing, but he asks further. He wants to know if they are abiding, if they're practicing, if they're living with real spiritual effort and diligence and resolution, commitment to the spiritual path, and whether or not they have a real ardour for spiritual development. And Anuruddha replies that yes, they do live like that. And what he then describes is the way in which they organise their daily activities, how they do their daily activities, how they mindfully deal with the practicalities of begging their food, coming back from their begging round and cleaning their place and putting out water for one another, and how they help one another in that, and how they do all that in complete silence. Each of them fully alert to one another. And of course, their life is so simple. It's so simple. It's stripped down to the bare necessities, if you like, so that everything that they do is a meditation. Nothing interrupts their flow of mindfulness and meditation. It all has that quality. So this is very interesting. Their vigorous spiritual practice is their mindful, collective, cooperative life. No doubt when they're not doing these practical things, they're sitting meditating. They're practicing metta, mindfulness of breathing, perhaps recollecting the Buddha, their teacher. perhaps reflecting on different aspects of the Dharma, but their daily activities, the humble things like filling up the water pot for the latrine, or the water pot for drinking, or sweeping, they're all part of the practice. Their awareness of each other is all part of the practice. There is nothing left out from their practice. So often we can't make progress in meditation because the rest of our life, the rest of our days and weeks are so fractured, so out of tune with our values and our spiritual life. And the people we are with are so opposed, perhaps who we work with, who we even live with, are so opposed to what we're trying to do in our Buddhist life. It's why some Buddhists live together and even work together. Why we need to go away on retreat together. The greater harmony that there is between our meditative life and our Dharma practice, the greater progress will be made. Aniruddha also adds in his reply that every 5 days, the three of them stay up all night long, discussing Dhamma. The Pali word here is Dhammakatha, which means literally talking Dhamma. Not talking about Buddhism, but talking the truth, which Sangharakshita has described this Dhammakatha as a deep, searching exploration of the truth. So I imagine the three of them in the warm Indian night under that deep velvet blue sky ablaze with silver stars, with all the sweet scents of the sal tree blossoms and perhaps jasmine creeper. I imagine them sitting out, taking some Dhamma teaching and really going into it together. How it applies to them, how they see it, how they feel it, how they experience it, how they might deepen their realization. I imagine this discussion being punctuated with long and deep silences. And perhaps in that silence, there's a direct mind-to-mind communication of what they're talking about. I imagine their discussion is really more, can be perhaps be better described as entering into the ocean of Dhamma. Their exploration would open up new transformative insights for one another. This, by the way, is what our study groups should be like. You're going into your discussion groups later, so aspire to this kind of discussion. And the Buddha is pleased at hearing all this. He says, sadhu, sadhu, Aniruddha. Good, good, bravo, bravo. But he asks, is there anything beyond that? Any further attainment? In the text, I think you've got, it says, any superhuman state that you've realised beyond the ordinary? And Aniruddha replies that yes, they all three abide in the first jhana, as it's called, the first higher meditative state. And the dialogue goes on between the Buddha and Aniruddha like this. And so to cut that short, what Aniruddha tells the Buddha is that he and his friends have entered into and abided in all of the higher, expanded, boundless states of consciousness, the realms of pure form, the realms that are formless. In fact, they have destroyed, through insight, through wisdom, the deep inner poisonous floods that would keep them unenlightened, bounded, imprisoned. They were, all three, fully liberated, enlightened. They'd reached the highest, the most sublime state of all. And of course, the Buddha is pleased. He's well pleased. And he can leave them in retreat, happily, getting on with their exploration of the Dharma. But before doing so, he gives them a Dhamma teaching, no doubt opening up even more of the truth for them, if that's possible. Greater riches, greater treasures would have been in that communication of the Buddha, because the Buddha was face to face with his disciples who really wanted to know, really wanted to hear, really wanted to receive. They were really living the life, so he could open up even more to them. So these three monks are a great example for us, a great inspiration for us. They make it clear what we need to do, what we need to do on this weekend, what we need to do for the rest of the retreat. Whether you're here for the weekend or you're staying longer, this story makes it clear what we need to do to make progress. We need to recognise this great opportunity, what a gain it is to have this time and this place in which to practice. It's not always easy to have the right time and place, the right conditions, but we have this time and place. And we are with people who are also practicing, who are also doing it. You might not know many of the people here if you're new to things, but you can be confident, I'm very confident, that everybody who's come here has made an effort, a great effort. Some have come a long way to be here. So all people here are serious about the good, capital G, serious about developing themselves along the path of the Dharma. What a gain it is to be with such people. How good it is to dwell with such people. We don't need to know all the details of their life, but we know that they're serious because they're here. Then be friendly. You might not be able to experience and feel overwhelming loving kindness immediately. That might be asking too much for any of us. But be friendly. Be helpful. Step outside yourself. Look out for others in a practical way. Help people who might be struggling, not knowing, you know, where to go. And if you're new at Padmaloka, I mean, it can sometimes be a bit like being in a small village. You don't know, you know, you say go to this room and you suddenly find yourself somewhere else. So if you see anybody like that, put out a hand, help them. Might seem a small thing, but that is spiritual practice. Look out for others. You see somebody looking downcast, ask them if they're okay, if they're all right. Be helpful. And discuss the Dhamma. Discuss the truth deeply. Bring yourself to it honestly. You don't have to agree with everything. You might have all sorts of questions. Bring that out in order to understand more deeply what the Dhamma life, the Buddhist life, is, who the Buddha is. Meditate. Meditate each day and bring awareness and warmth to all that you do. And allow yourself to perhaps, just a little bit, if you can, to open up to the Buddha. Let's at least try to live like that in the coming days. Just to come back, though, to our story, there's a strange ending to this story. After leaving the three friends, the Buddha is sitting in meditation and a yaka comes to him, named Diga Parajana. A yaka is a very powerful nature spirit, a sort of spirit of place, very important in ancient India, for the local deities, if you like. And this yaka is very pleased. He's delighted that the Buddha and the three friends, Anuruddha, Kimbila, Nandiya, are dwelling in the land. In fact, all the gods are pleased. It's as if the natural forces of the land, of nature, and even of the cosmos feel that the Buddha and the three friends enrich the land. They bring harmony to the land itself. They recognize that and support that. The earth and the heavens are glad at the harmony that has come. And the Buddha agrees with the yaka and responds, saying that these three men living like this do so for the happiness and the well-being of the many folk, the Bahujan, the people, all the people. That is the way they express their compassion for the world, by living like that It might seem strange that the Buddha describes three men living in retreat like this as doing so for the welfare of the world out of compassion for the world, but it's not really so strange. The world, the people, all the people need examples. We all need examples, living examples of people living in friendship, living in loving kindness, living in harmony, living selflessly for one another. All Buddhists need to take this seriously. All of us need to be living examples of friendship, brotherhood, love, metta. In that way, we can inspire others to live like that. Let's dedicate these coming days to creating such friendship as this. Let's aspire to be able to say, we may have 58 or 60, however many it is, bodies, but assuredly, we have only one mind.